Hey, welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors. We are teaching Americans how to persuade Americans. You can find us on social media, Rhetoric Warriors, Twitter, Instagram, Pentagram, Unigram. or visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com, where you can take our one-year master course in persuasion. Not that you need it, but maybe you want to recover lost family members who are lost to some weird political alternate universe. Maybe you want to ramp up your business marketing, or maybe you just want to get the non-crazy people elected again. We'll show you how to do all of that in the course. I am Dr. Dan. I am the founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I have a PhD in rhetoric. Yes, that's a real thing. I'm also an escaped professor. Used to teach college. No longer teach 18-year-olds things they don't want to hear. Longtime stand-up comedy comedian, comedy writer in late night in Hollywood for a long time. And I started Rhetoric Warriors to give people some tools to be able to figure some things out. So maybe I have people to talk to. The podcast, the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, has three purposes. We convert right wingers. Like I have people, Trump voters and MAGA people on, and my goal is to convert them out of that. That's fun. I also talk to comedians about their politics, see how their crazy brains interpret everything that's going on. And I find persuasion pros to tell you all the secrets you need to magically take people from where they are to where you want them to be, which is the game. So this week, I'm going to introduce my guest here real quick. One of my favorite comedians, and that's not even an exaggeration. It's so easy to exaggerate when you're exaggerating, but one of my favorite stand-ups, Bent Washburn. He's from an alternative religion. Something that just floated in late in the game, pretty late in the game, I think. He's married to what I would call his occupational opposite.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think that's right.
He has a thing against living in the U.S.
Yeah, lately. Yeah. so do Americans, apparently.
Yeah, well, right. He has a PhD. Don't you have a PhD?
Masters. Masters. There's no PhD in studio art.
Oh, that's right. We talked about that. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit. He's done stand-up comedy for, 30 years?
Almost 30, yeah.
30 years.
Well, this last year doesn't count, but
yeah,
I stopped at 28.
Got to give that 2 months. It has 2 months, and then we were done. And he's the only person named Bent on the planet for the last 400 years, I think.
Pretty much. Yeah. Close. Well, Bent Washburn. I'm the only Bent Washburn.
So. That's true. But there are other Bents.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? I got knocked out. I used to be the top Google search, and then there's some Swedish entertainer, and then some Swedish Bent Holmstrom. He got a Nobel Prize.
I hate it when that happens.
Got bumped off by a Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah, jeez. There's a taxidermist that beats me on Google searches.
A taxidermist? Really?
Yeah. And the only famous Daniel French that I could find is the sculptor who sculpted the Abraham Lincoln Monument.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was Daniel French. I didn't know that. Daniel I should French. Know that.
Should
Why
you?
Don't I know that?
Why would anybody know that?
I don't know. I got a degree in art. Well, yeah, I guess I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of art out there. So everybody, welcome Bent Washburn. Bent, how's it going today?
Well, it's been going this well for when did this all start? About, it's going all right. I'm alive. I'm okay.
Yeah, we're 9 months, 10 months, come up on 10 months?
Is that where we are? Are we 10 months into this?
I think it started beginning of March, like mid-February, beginning of March, and we're middle of December, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're doing, we're cruising right along. Should be. So I'm doing all right, like everybody, I think. I haven't been doing stand-up. You know, if I was, it'd probably be bad, because I think that what the news and the culture has been feeding me, it would be so hard to keep my job. I had started to do cruise ships, and I don't think I could have.
Oh yeah, continued. You couldn't talk those topics at all, right?
Not at all. And I I wonder, I don't know how I would have done that. It would have just been painful because I wouldn't have been able to say a thing.
So the whole world, yeah, the whole world is catching fire outside and you're talking about puppies.
Yeah. And that's what I had one joke I did. It feels like they tell me not to joke about it. And I feel like I'm not just any cruise ship. I'm on the Titanic. It's sinking. They asked me to do a set and then don't mention, if you could not mention the water and the ice, just don't. The captain would rather. It felt that way. Like this
no
is
iceberg. But I've got a huge chunk. Literally.
I got a huge chunk. How could I not? Because it really feels that way. And I still avoid it, the topic of politics, quite a bit. I think.
Yeah, but surely you've written stuff, right? You have your Trump stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I had some Trump stuff right before the election. I had quite a bit of material that I ran with. And then after the election, I stopped doing it. I started getting into these corporate gigs and cruise ships, and clubs didn't want to hear it. No one wanted to hear it. I liked them. Some of them were easy. He's a real estate, he's just a real estate guy. When he gets the White House, first thing he'll do is flip it, which has not been far from the truth.
Right? Really. Yeah. The tennis courts, get rid of the Rose Garden. Yeah.
He's flipping the whole country. The one I had that I think was along the lines of what Rhetoric Warriors is about was I said all the political mudslingers have their work cut out for them. And I said, what I mean is cut out. You don't have any work to do now. He's like the first president ever who you don't have to take what he says out of context to make it sound bad.
Right.
At all. You remember when we were first shocked by what he would say? He'd come out and you'd think, oh, that's got to be out of context. And you would read it in its larger context and it would get worse. You're like, yeah. Wow, this is insane. I don't think this has ever happened in our lifetime. I don't think.
It started right from the get-go, right? Like two things, his inauguration size, like went right after the media, even though there were aerial photos that showed the exact truth, and then his inauguration speech was insane. That was the thing that George Bush, reportedly turned to Hillary Clinton and went, well, that was fucking weird.
Turns out there's a different word for it. It's not weird. It's despotic. I don't know.
It's insane though. I mean, like the amount of things, like, I wonder if you tracked all the outrageous things that Trump has said over these 4 years, like it's got to be in the thousands.
Oh, easily, easily. Like stuff that if you forced someone to be honest intellectually about what they were looking at, you would not lose one. You would never lose the argument. Right. I mean, if reason could function in the brain on the other side, if there was any kind of way for me to get the gears together, there's no way.
I'm comparing it right now to like World War II. So like, the whole world was at war, but you can only take like one, like tiny island at a time. That's all you could really do. And like, if you can go in and just take one little island from the right and get a little bit of reasonableness on one island, then you've won that battle for, the week or the month or whatever. Don't try to take over all the land at once because they're just too confused.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it is. It's too big of a bite. And that will happen a lot. The few times I wander into a thread on Facebook, that's why I quit. Like I do one joke, like the last joke I did on Trump was that it just kept getting under my skin when they'd say he's an unconventional president. I'm like, you've got to be shitting me. This is a misuse of the word unconventional. This is not. So the joke was Trump is an unconventional president in the same way that Jeffrey Dahmer is an unconventional mortician. And I thought it was a little bit, you know, what's the word? I thought it was hyperbole, but I don't now. I really don't. I think he's that. He's a little too accurate. And the thread of comments and the way they would wander and all these devices, logical fallacies, just a stream of, I don't know the names for all of them. But I see like the straw man, you know, well, first of all, well, I'll move the goalpost and set up another straw man, and then I'll prop him up with some circular logic. And it's just such a fire hose of stupidity. You're like, wow, this is incredibly complexly dumb.
It is complexly dumb. That's exactly the way to look at it. Like I call it skew world. Like when everything, like all the logical connections and logical structures get broken and replaced with illogical structures, but they still connect it all. It still has all the hues of logic. It's just everything in there is skewed. It's, you know, it's literally false, but it's very complex.
It is incredibly complex. And I don't know what place they grew up in where they were trained, or do you naturally find this? Is it something, a muscle you develop in combat, you know, in verbal combat, when you don't have, when you're just trying to bully someone verbally or win, or it's intense.
Yeah. Social media is a very different form of human communication. You know, this kind of completely no consequence communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
You never had that before.
Never, never. Wait, the dog's sneaking in here. No, what? It's the daughter, not the dog.
Hey,
it's
daughter.
The daughter. Hey, I'm doing this, okay?
I'm going to take a bath.
Okay, you take a bath. Sorry, that's in the podcast now.
Vint has clean kids. That's in the podcast.
Yeah, that's at least for today.
So run your background a little bit. I gave you an obscurest intro so that you could actually still have punchlines on some of this. Just run your background a little bit for everybody, because it's a very interesting background.
Is it? I think it's not anymore.
Well, there's levels, but it's still you still have some exotic points in your biography.
I think so. I grew up in a little town, which is normal, but it was Mormon, which is a little not as common. But then my dad was a psychiatrist, which is a Mormon psychiatrist in the 60s or 70s. A psychiatrist in the 60s or 70s is pretty weird.
Yeah,
that is. I mean, he's like 5 years. He started practice 5 years after they told him to knock it off with the ice pick lobotomies. I mean, he's that.
Ah.
You know what I mean? He's that. Because he probably started his practice 62, 63.
Oh, wow. Ice pick lobotomies. Oh.
Those are the first ones, weren't they? That just performed in Utah, I do believe. It wasn't my dad, but it was someone.
Who was the first surgeon who was like, you know what? I don't think we really, all I need is an ice pick.
We're overthinking this. We're overthinking the brain surgery.
Wow.
Anyway, so that is quite different, I think, as a psychiatrist, and what that says about human behavior and morality and all those kinds of things.
Sure.
And being a Mormon. And then I was raised in that little town. I loved art. I ended up going to school in fine art. And I got my master's in that.
You painted, right?
I painted, mostly painted, draw and paint, but wasn't a lot of money in it, Dan, I gotta say.
Yeah. What? I see these paintings going for like $400 million.
I know. And that's why I gave up. Because usually they were horrible. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I mean, not the classics, but there was a lot of bad stuff. Kincaid. Do you know who Kincaid is?
Kincaid. Maybe.
He's no Dan French. Lincoln and Memorial, but
thank God.
He does those really sappy paintings of lights and or not light, but little cottage looking.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry. I got it.
Painter of light.
Painter of
anyway, light. I studied fine art, and then I quit being Mormon after divorce, and I just, I'd always wanted to stand up. I just didn't think I could do it and go to heaven.
Well, it's a good trade-off, really. I mean, no stand-ups in heaven. I think that may be on the door.
You might be right. There might not be any up there, but or down there. Or, you know, I don't want to say. I don't know. But
well, that's probably what happens to you in hell if you're a professional stand-up. You just have to watch open micers. And you never get on stage.
Or Zoom. It's all Zoom shows.
It's all Zoom shows.
Yeah, that's stand-up hell. So I don't know. I guess that's, I don't know if that's, I think it, my background definitely made me an outsider.
Sure.
To not only mainstream Mormon culture, because I'm not a Mormon, I don't go anymore, mainstream Mormon culture, but mainstream American culture. And both on the right and left. I mean, if you want to, that's such a, as you pointed out to me, that's such a bad way to set up everything. But you know what I mean? Across all spectrums, Mormons sure. are kind of you're an outsider. You're just an outsider.
Yeah, because you were, I would assume, raised conservatively.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much so. I'm really conservative. We're talking, I heard apologist rants on behalf of Nixon. It wasn't that uncommon. And I mean, seriously, I mean, the assassination of Kennedy, let's just say they weren't as sad as a lot of people. They really weren't. You know, it was kind of like, well, Oswald's was with Lee Harvey. Yeah, his heart was in the right place, you know. Wow. Which I feel like that's where we are now. I mean, I hear people, well, yeah, but if the congressmen don't approve the Electoral College and they hold it to vote and Trump wins, their heart's in the right place. I know. I mean, that's, it's the same kind of idiocy. It's insane, but it was conservative, very conservative. And the John Bircher Society was big in Mormon culture when I was really young, really big. And do you know
the John Birch Society exactly? I've looked it up before and it never sticks.
Super right wing, anti-communist, just batshit crazy. Batshit crazy. I remember picking up some book my mom's had sitting in the house and she had quit them. She decided they were nuts. As did my dad. He's a psychiatrist. He would know. But they thought abstract art was a communist plot. Everything was a communist plot. It sure. was always.
It was communists. They had, they yeah. were plotters.
And they are. I actually they
still
think they are.
Yeah, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They are. So it's like, they John Birch seems less crazy every day. But so I was very conservative. And then, which makes stand-up a problem, I think.
Yeah, why is that?
Well,
it goes against your politics. Like, do you feel out of step with stand-up? Because stand-up is super liberal.
Yeah, that's why. When I go into stand-up, I felt, what I thought was edgy was not even anywhere. Yeah, it really puts me out of step. And a lot of comics, I sometimes when I do, I think. Comedy that attacks, that punches what I perceive to be is punching up. A lot of other comics don't see it that way. Like, well, that's not punching up. What are you doing?
Like what? Give me an example of that.
Well, I have done some jokes that, what was the joke? It's about, it's on the last special where I talk about shopping for television. And I'll say the gist of the joke is I'm trying to pick out the television. Is this Sony? Should I go with the Sony, famous Japanese brand, or should I go with the LG? And I turn to the clerk and I say, all Asian televisions look alike to me. They just all do. And and some of the audience always moans. I say, and that's what he did. He's like you. He said, but I'm not trying to be racist. I'm making fun of, I'm not sure. Being racist.
Yeah.
I'm just And I couldn't tell the difference between TVs. The clerk could. Of course he could. He's Korean or Japanese. I can't tell. But the point is, so then it's a big, long, or not a big, long, but a longer bit when the audience lets me.
Yeah.
Talking about when this word and category and how it causes, it can cause damage as we wield it and is it. And some people, I will say on the left, don't like you to talk about that. They don't want you. I found in the comments, they get very mad.
Yeah, for sure. The left is, so anytime I think when you get to the continuum of beliefs, you know, where the left has been wounded, you know, or the right feels wounded, then you get this hyperactivity of emotion and they can't intellectualize anymore. I say, like, a lot of times both of those poles, they've been booby trapped, you know? So as soon as I hear the words, explosions go off.
That is it. That is it.
And it's no fun. It's absolutely, I dated a woman from Oakland for a while and she was super far West Coast, you know, super liberal. And she picked out like words. I would just be saying things and she'd be like, that's sexist or this is then. And I'm like, you're no fun. You're no fun to talk to.
It's done. I can't. I don't. There's so much baggage. There's so many loaded words everywhere. But as a comic, you know, if you're going to wander into those waters, you have to know how to. You can't let them surprise you. You have to know when that's going to go off and you have to be ready to address it. And to it's.
Yeah. And I've thought about this a lot watching, you know, guys like Stanhope and all these.
Yeah.
Sort of touchy social issue comics over the years. And really the refuge is always intellectualism. Bill Barr does this too. They'll go up into intellectualism to be able to talk about a topic and they'll find, you know, hypocritical positions on the side that's getting upset. And that gives them legitimacy to get in there and talk about it. But man, you misstep just a little bit.
Oh, and it's over. And it's still and for some people it is over, period. I mean, I'll meet him, I can't stand it. I'm like, he's okay. So you are gonna lose a lot of, so it's almost like you have to reach a critical mass if you're that kind of comic with followers, or it's never gonna, you can't do cruise ships. I love Stanhope and Burr. It's so fun to watch.
Well, they're, you know, it's a mastery that they can get in there and do it. I see a lot of the non-mastery that they've influenced here in Austin.
Oh, where,
you know, they'll get up and they'll want to do the same stuff and they just don't have the intellectual chops.
Oh, no.
To get in there and stay safe.
They really don't. And I've seen imitators of Burr, Stanhope, Louis C.K., and Patton Oswalt. I think the ugliest one is when people try to do the Patton Oswalt, because to me, he's not as blunt force. Well, no, this Louis C.K. imitators were pretty, it was bad too. but it's like, there's just, it's such a train wreck when someone tries to jump into those things and they just think that guy is up there just rambling. They have no idea.
Right. They don't know how, you know, like if you're going to wear clown shoes in a minefield, as I've said, you better make sure where your feet are, you know.
You better be damn good. Yeah. And they make it look so easy that those guys just assume, well, this is easy. No, they're making it look easy and it's incredibly hard.
So you've got some interesting, I think, you know, one of the ways that comedians get legitimized to be able to talk about those issues, clearly it's if they are from those groups, then they're legitimate to talk about it. You know, they can sort of, like you said, punch up or punch out of their group. But like you are outgrouped. I just don't think most people see it because you're, you know, a white male, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. So that just goes over all, right? You can't.
It's just an easy read. It's an easy thing for people to read, but everybody is far more complicated in their biography underneath that. Like with you, you know, the Mormon background, as soon as you, that was your first set of material, right? When you were talking about that, I remember the material about meeting your wife, you know,
yeah.
Because that makes you, like you said, that's an outsider. It's a small subgroup of religion. And once you get that legitimacy, then you can start talking about other things.
Yeah. Yeah, that is part of when you're talking about, I don't know how Bill Burr does it. I don't get how he does it.
He does a lot of self-deprecation. Like if you watch him, he constantly says, you know, I'm nuts. I'm Irish, you know, German. I can't control myself. I'm in therapy now, you know. So he admits he's wrong, but then he goes after the group anyway.
Goes. And it's beautiful. But I think that outsider's that kind of, you're right. You have to be, somehow you have to get license. You have to get permission from this audience to do this joke. And if they haven't heard all that background stuff and I go into some of this stuff, I lose a lot of people really fast. And I got sick of constantly, okay, let's, I'm gonna say some stuff, but it's okay for me to say this because blah, blah, blah. And then on we go. And I got tired of having to do that, you know?
Yeah. It's supposed to be right that stand-ups have implicit permission. It's comedy. They're not supposed to be applying their real feelings and their real politics and all that. Comedy is a space set aside so that we can listen to somebody without all this moral judgment. I mean, comedy has no moral foundation.
I didn't think so either, Dan, but I think we might be wrong.
Well, I think people, again, in sort of these hyperbolic times, apply their moral, you know, distinctions to everything. They can't stop it. So I've had this argument for years, ever since I first started doing stand-up. There was a comic named Roger Rittenhouse. Do you know Roger?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know him personally, but what a great writer.
Great writer. Just a fun stand-up and just talking about stomping on, you know, anything.
Anything.
Any cute thing that comes nearby. But he used to do, you know, he has his saves with it about he would, you know, tell a racist joke or whatever. And he'd be like, hey, you know, if you are Mexican, God bless you. You know, thanks for coming out tonight. And you know, and just watching him do that, and he did a bit, and it really pissed off a woman that I was seeing back in grad school, and she went after him. We all went out and played pool afterwards, and she beelined right for him and just went after him for that joke.
Man, what did he do? Did he say sorry? What's your problem? You know, like
he doesn't. You know, Roger doesn't engage, you know, once he's done, he's done. He's like, I'm not arguing with you about this. Like he literally just keeps dancing away. It's like, you know, it's like rope-a-dope.
Hey, bye. Yes, it should be. It should be that way.
Yeah. It's not his job to defend jokes. It's not your job to argue the value of a joke. It's your job to write the jokes.
Yeah. I write the jokes and I keep doing them. When it gets large groups of people to laugh, you know, and then that should be enough. If I can get the majority of the room to laugh, I should be the comedian or the president. It goes both ways, you know, it's the way it goes. And you would think, but there seems to be a need to impose. Well, we're in the middle of a culture war in America. And so they're always looking to know whose side you're on. There are certain people, these people in these wars that just, are you on my side? Or are you on?
Yeah, that's what happens in wars. You pretty much want to know who's going to be shooting at you.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why maybe I'm in Germany.
So talk about that. So that's the other thing. So you grew up Mormon, you started doing stand-up, and then you are married to?
She's an officer. She was an officer in the Air Force, a public affairs officer who speaks fluent French, that alone, and speaks some Arabic, and she has a degree in Middle Eastern studies, and now she does public affairs for the military AFRICOM command, which is based here in Germany. And they're just working a little overtime now because the president decided to install a bunch of morons into the Pentagon before he left. I'm not even kidding. I'm not even joking. Just
ideological. What's that look like? You've got a perch that other people don't have, you know, about this stuff.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I understand, you know, the average, say, person who's a Trump supporter out in middle America that would say, maybe even did some years as a in the military. I don't think they understand how much a lot of the military people who have to actually run things and work with people do not appreciate the current guy. They really, I mean, they didn't like the guy before either. They really weren't a fan of Obama, but man, I would say they probably even miss him at this point. This guy is, and that's saying something, because they didn't like Obama, but they.
Why didn't they like Obama? What were the complaints about Obama?
You know, I could never put a finger on a lot of it. I think some of it was policy, for sure. Some of it was policy. They wanted to stay places where he didn't want them to stay, or, you know, just these kind of squabbles. And I get the feeling that sometimes if a president has run-ins with the leaders, it trickles down, you know, and they hear stuff. So I could never put a finger on why they hated him so much. Did he cut their budget a lot? I don't know. Did he?
I don't really, I wasn't tracking politics during the Obama years.
But now it's just the latest moves are insane. It's insane. It's complete withdrawals. We don't want to get into this, I guess. It's not funny.
It doesn't matter. Like, I think my whole goal here is, like, part of it's entertainment, but part of it's just, if you have, you know, insights or, you know, information about things that other, that people typically don't get, I find that interesting.
You know, but I do have, I get info from her that a normal person wouldn't get. Like, she came home and, you know, Morocco signed on to recognize Israel as a state. Now, the average person, especially, say, a Trump supporter, says, see, there you go, will say, what they don't understand is, in order to get that deal, we had to recognize the western section of Morocco, which Algeria has been fighting with them over for a long time. So now when we do that in Morocco, we say, we'll give you this if you recognize Israel. Now we're in trouble with Algeria. And why is that important? Well, because Algeria works with us to fight terrorism. You know who doesn't? Israel really doesn't. Israel is not, you would think they're with it, but every time we go to them in a war, they're like, sorry, our hands are full. We really can't. We would like to help in Afghanistan, but, you know, it'll cause problems with our own. We can't. And that's every war we do. They're a very expensive ally. So now they became more expensive. And what people don't understand about all these peace treaties with Israel is the price tag is a price tag that other presidents, Obama, Bush, all, have looked at and said, you know, that's too much to ask. We shouldn't do that. That's not smart. But this guy, sure, yeah, just all of it.
Yeah, see, now that's a piece of, like, you know, there's so much going on. Like, you just mentioned Algeria. I bet you 90% of America doesn't even know Algeria is real. Like,
yeah, that's probably true.
It sounds like, you know, maybe you've heard of it in a movie at some point, right?
Like, yeah,
Casablanca is real. Like, it's a real place, but
yeah.
You know, we don't have any, like, of that information. And now you've just introduced this, you know, complicated politics based on, you know, sort of cost ratios and what's this going to do, you know, in the 20 years in the future. We don't have any of that.
So that's why that never works in an argument, that stuff, right? Am I right? It never helps.
Because you're having to back, like, it's always a bad idea of trying to teach people before you persuade them. It doesn't work. This is a big problem in marketing. Like, marketing, there's so many things that have to be done with every message that you create for a product. Like, people don't even know what the product is. They never heard of it. So you have to, like, give them information, but information is not persuasion. So then you wear them out with your information and then they don't want to hear anything else. So you've gotten no traction.
I do that all the time. The other favorite thing that I'll do is explain to people what an emergency use authorization is when it comes to COVID test failures. And they don't, what? They don't. The other one, my favorite, is when Trump withdrew troops from Kurdistan region, you know, northern Syria. It was only like, I think, like 1,000 Marines, so that he could tell his constituents back home, see, I'm bringing them home. And now what that did Did you know about this? He tweeted this retreat. Did you remember this?
He's tweeted a few of them. I don't remember that one.
It's just a fire hose of idiocy. That's the problem. And every idiot thing he does is something that the deep state will understand, the evil deep state. They get why it's dumb. But the average person doesn't have a clue how dumb and dangerous it is. But what he did with the Kurds, first of all, when told the troops,
the Kurds,
he told our troops to come home. The Kurds were our allies, literally fighting by our side and protecting our supply lines as we fought ISIS there at the end, trying to wrap things up. So what Trump did is he just tweeted, they're coming home. He didn't tell the general in charge. This is when General, what's his name, resigned, Mattis.
Yeah.
This is when Mattis said, this man's not fit to be a president, which is a big deal for a guy like that to say that. That's a huge deal. But anyway, in the military, that's huge. So he does that. When the Kurds found this out, Dan, they literally dropped everything and ran home because they knew it meant that their villages in Kurdistan would now be overrun by the Turkish troops because they hate them there, which is exactly what happened about 3 days later. So Trump tweets this. He cuts off supply lines to his own soldiers. They have to run home. Our Kurdish allies get pushed under the bus and never be with us again. They were totally with us. They had protected status on the border of Turkey, Syria, Iraq. They had money from Iraq, oil from that. We had literally a forward operating position with an ally totally willing to fight that was funded by Iraq oil right in the gut of everything. And it was cheap. It was so cheap. It's like $1,000. It's such a bargain to have this, just this place. And the Kurdistan, they loved us there. They wanted us there. And they were happy. They'd been there almost 12 years now, eight under Obama. Actually, almost 16 years when this happened. Four under Bush, eight under Obama. They'd been establishing a community. They're still building their villages. And with one tweet, that asshole kicked them all out of their homes, created like 60 plus thousand refugees. A few hundred die, you know, and we retreat. So now when fighting or some horrible attack breaks out, which it's going to, we're going to have to spend billions. Now, this is a comic talking. I don't know. So I might be wrong. Billions, you know. So
almost like they want to spend that money.
We want to, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost like we want to spend more military money.
Yeah. It's just, so anyway, I'll explain that one to someone. But there's so much to unpack there.
Yeah. You know? And again, you know, like you started talking about it until you said Kurds. It's just a word I know, you know, it's been thrown around like, you know, Hussein gassed the Kurds, right?
Yeah. And you're thinking, is that a K or a C? Are we talking cooking or?
They're just lucky they've got an easy name. Otherwise, Americans wouldn't, you know, retain it at all.
Yeah. But that's why you need, I think, a deep state. You need people who know.
Yeah, I think the whole, it's funny to me, like deep state has basically become the cover word for educated people. Like experienced people in government are now deep state.
And it's terrifying that they want to kick them all out. It's just, it's like these armchair quarterbacks literally are on the field right now, playing every position. And it's just a nightmare.
Well, see, there you've got some uplifting military prognosis, you know, from the husband of somebody that's actually.
Someone who's, but she doesn't really know. We don't know.
Nobody knows, but, yeah.
Yeah.
So again, like, you know, with comedy, so have you tried to pull any of that over into stand-up? Like, you've ever done any kind of, you know, I know you do a little bit about your wife, like do the bit. I always love the bit about, you know, your wife and the camouflage and.
Oh yeah. And going to the office when she used to go to the office every day, everyone. And that's true. Camouflage. And then you go in the office. I can see all of you, you guys. I can. Yeah. Which is, it is funny, I guess. Should I do it? That bad?
Yeah, just run it. That's fine. Yeah.
Let's go. I can't even remember it. It's been 9 months, Dan. But she is a public affairs officer which means every morning she has to wake up, put on camouflage clothing designed for jungle combat, and then go to an office and answer emails while dressed like a bush. Which is, and I told him, when I did tell him, I used to do that, to go to the office, say, you know, I can see all of you, everyone, it's bad. If you had more plants in here, then that would help bring some cover to work. But right now, if the enemy attacks, here's the plan. Storm the building, shoot all the plants. We'd have lose everybody. And then you should be going to work dressed as file cabinets. That's what you should. It makes sense. And why Kelly's short, so she'd just be like a little three drawer major file cabinet. The top drawer open, her top drawer would have to be, because she's got a grade A through J. So, yes, that's it. That's what a kind
great
of
bit. That's a great bit. You know,
I think it works. It keeps working.
Yeah. How many? How old is that bit? Like, how many years you've been telling that bit?
Oh, long. 12, 13 years now, maybe 14. Because I wrote it when we first lived in Germany while she was in the office here. I think that's when I first really started working it. So yeah, 12 years. It's and amazing. It changed. It's interesting. They change, you know, they keep morphing. But man, what do you do? I can't keep writing new ones, Dan. I can actually. But I think
part of that double thing, right? Like, you always can create new material. That's always what you're doing, because that keeps you interested as a comic, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, like, to make a living as somebody going out and delivering high premium goods, you know, at the point of delivery to an audience, you know, all these bits will work. I just have lost interest in them a million years ago. You know,
yeah.
It becomes an acting exercise, right?
It is an acting exercise. Yeah. And I actually kind of enjoyed exploring that for a bit, for about the first year doing ships. It was interesting to get to kind of like, wow, this is really hard doing the same jokes over and over. Because I hadn't done that my whole career till then. The first 20 something years, I would cycle in a new hour. So if you came to see me, you might see a really good hour. You might see a really good 30 minutes and then 30 that were a bit off. And that's what I did for like the first 20 years. I just would
write. It keeps you intellectually engaged, right? Because you know the part that's coming up that you're going to have to really, you know, think through while it's happening is the new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, well, I wonder too, if as you get older, my head just has a harder time. Well, for one thing, I'm not in that constant mental dialogue. I mean, I used to just have a running dialogue, just a running me, I don't know what I was talking to myself in my car or whatever. And I would get on stage and I would literally just kind of dip into the dialogue at any place and just play for an hour and then get off stage. And that's how it was for quite a few years. But that changes, I guess.
Yeah, but it's amazing that, you know, people don't really understand, like, when you get to do full-time stand-up and you can dedicate a huge amount of your brain to it, probably more than it deserves.
Yeah.
Your family would like some of that brain, but you're like giving them you give them your third gear. You're like, I got to keep my first gear for my stand-up.
It's true, yeah.
But you're constantly, you know, working through these scripts and every word and every looking for a new idea that unlocks something. Mm-hmm. It's a totalizing art. Like, you do it all the time.
Yeah. Oh, it is. You're right. It takes everything to do it well, just to do it well. And then, I mean, great. I have no idea how to do that, but man, just to do it well, it takes the whole thing, I think.
Well, I think I was always fascinated, like, when you moved to Germany with your wife, you know, and you came back, I saw like your years in Germany, like you could feel just how saturated that experience was in your stand-up, you know, because you went to Germany and you brought back kind of alive all these sort of, you know, bits, you know, these sort of living bits from Germany.
I think I did that. Yeah. I took that brain and that whole thing over there and bumped around with it, and it just grabbed onto stuff. And then I brought them back. And I remember coming back and having these bits that were kind of raw at that point, which is to me is when they're the most fun.
Right.
I'm having by far the most fun when they're raw and I'm finding stuff. And I still think they might be great, every one of them.
It's like, I can get it to, no, I can't get any farther than this. Damn it.
Yeah. I don't know what, there was a period for a few years in comedy, I thought that it was all about if I could just find the right combination of words in this bit, in this joke, I would have this thing, this amazing that I would just go to some audition or to some manager or something, just here you go. And then they go, oh my God, this is stop everything, you know? And it's not, I don't think it quite works like that.
Well, the only difference I see in you and, you know, guys like Louis C.K. or Burr is those guys tapped into a different market than you work. Like they have that younger sort of aggro, you know, kind of shock loving audience.
Yeah.
And it's a big audience, you know, and it actively likes stand up and it actively buys, you know, tickets versus like you, I would say you're more, you know, kind of a, I don't know, normal culture guy.
Yeah.
You're not speaking to the 20-year-olds who are like, oh yeah, Louis C.K. and his bag of dicks jokes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're speaking to grownups.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're a horrible audience.
Well, they're horrible for making you super famous unless,
yeah,
unless you tag into their formats of maybe, you know, like a family sitcom or something.
Yeah. And you're right. It is. They're much more mature than, I think when you get a certain level of maturity, it's really hard to manufacture fame in those kinds of, you know what I mean? Like those young people, you want to be the cool thing that they put on. I wear this kind of sneaker and this sweater and I listen to Bill Burr. I mean, it really is so much of that. It's that identity construction or whatever you call it, where they're just.
Yeah. And it's a rebellious, you know, identity that those guys, they all have the same identity. It's all hardcore rebellion against the normal culture. And they're all living deviant lifestyles and they'll have deviant views. And that's perfect for the younger audience. So they never lose audience, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas I think like you would have done very well if you could have broken into the media, like on a Cosby kind of level, you know, of that sort of normal, you know, married people watching, you know, stuff on TV. You would have gotten that same level of
action
just from a different.
But it has to be right place at the right time. I mean, so many of those things, which I didn't understand. I just thought it was, you're funny. I had that whole other world. I was so dumb. I still am. But I mean, at least I know it's there now.
Well, did you ever live in LA? Did you ever do the game, like the full?
I was, you know, right after Kelly and I met, and then we got married. And some people in LA liked what I was doing a lot. And I went down there and I met with some of them and they started working. Let's do a show. We have a vehicle for you. And I'd meet with her. She's a great lady and really smart, very perceptive and nice. And we would talk and meet, just hang out and work on this. And I did that for about a month. And then it became obvious that I had to move there. That was the thing. You have to. And I couldn't move there. I had a daughter I wanted to see from my first marriage in Utah. And I had Kelly. I didn't want to lose that. And I just
wouldn't have moved out. She wouldn't have moved to Los Angeles.
No. Yeah. Can you imagine?
I love Los Angeles. Los Angeles is crazy. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it is. But at that time, then Kelly and I had a son coming and she had a job that. Yeah, I think. Yeah. I did the right thing. I think I definitely
did. I'm sure you did the right thing. But it's like when you look at like, I mean, I've got friends Do you know Retta? Do you know who Retta is?
Nah.
She was a stand-up for a long time, and you'd recognize her. She was on Parks and Rec for quite a while, and then she's one of the three girls on, I think it's called Good Girls, with the redhead from Mad Men.
Oh, okay.
She's one of the leads on that. So I had her in a stand-up workshop years ago at Charlie Goodnight's in North Carolina. Like, she was right out of college, went to Duke, and, you know, showed up and started wanting to do stand-up. And so I worked with her some and, you know, helped her get started, and she immediately became very popular. She's really great on stage, great personality, big, big character, funny.
Yeah.
And so she moved to LA, you know, to want, you know, wanted to get into the track, you know, into the system, and immediately got representation. It took her, I would say 10 years, maybe longer, of being in LA, doing every gig, doing colleges to make a living, auditioning everywhere, taking acting classes, until she landed something real. And she wasn't even one of the leads on Parks and Rec. Yeah. She was a regular, but she's probably on every three episodes or whatever.
Yeah.
But from there, now she's, you know, she's in the pipe. But people don't realize like how much time it takes.
Oh, yeah. Of being there.
Being there.
That's not
auditioning
just doing
500
stand-up.
Times.
Yeah. Yeah, just being there. And I was doing stand-up. And then that's where I was just enjoying and creating and having fun.
Right.
And then seeing my daughter and Kelly. So I couldn't do that. But you're right. There's no replacing it.
Yeah, and all those guys, have to go, you know, Louis C.K. and Patton Oswalt and Maria Bamford and all that, none of them ever caught on with any kind of, you know, broad appeal until they moved full time to LA, or, you know, I guess Louis C.K. was bi-coastal, but you have to just, that's the only way to work back into your stand-up, is to break into the media to the point where they use you enough, they trust you, they can see that you can do some things. And none of those guys are great actors, you know, but they stay in it long enough where they get a little bit of acting chops so they can kind of compete with the real guys.
Yeah.
And then once they get known, then their stand-up just blows up.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they can do whatever they want. They have this license. And I guess CK was a writer. I mean, he was a full just writing for other people and writing and directing a lot until he got, man.
Well, and he blew up because he combined, to me, like, he combines those two genres. He combines your genre of, you know, the middle class married with kids with the hardcore deviant. And that was his show about his kids. It wasn't until he started talking about his kids that he blew up.
Yeah, that is when he blew up. And he went huge. It was this guy. And I've seen other comics do it. I mean, Chad Daniels just destroys me. One of the greatest. Definitely one of the greatest, but he talks about his kids and it's just, it's that same thing. I mean, it's very similar, but I've noticed too, with the way the business works, is once the people in power hold that archetype, they control one talent that holds the audience of that archetype, very hard for you to come up. Oh, hey, we have this guy who's kind of like that guy. And it's, they jealously guard it. And so do the fans. The fans guard it. They don't mean to, but if someone comes along who's similar to that guy, they've already seen that. Well, you're kind of like so-and-so, or this is so-and-so.
Like, yeah, I think that's true, but I think there are ways to work around it. I think, like with Chad, again, I think he's always lived in Wisconsin or Minnesota or whatever.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've known his name for years and I never watched his stand-up. And I've heard comedians praise him for years. And I finally, about a year ago, went in and started watching some of his stand-up, and I watched the whole, you know, catalog, you know, because it's just super sharp writing, you know, really, you know, surprising the things that he finds. But can he act? Can that translate over into something
that
he can use? I don't know. But he certainly has all the chops. He has all the things that you need.
Spectacular. And the thing is, I think he doesn't care because he managed to find a career. He's one of the few ones that outside of an LA, New York, landed this pure stand-up comedy career. It's really hard to do. without starting to do corporate or, you know, very hard. And he's one of them that it's hard. Him, Dan Cummins, I think, managed to do it. But Cummins was in L.A. for quite a while, actually.
Yeah, he's got an L.A. feel to him. He's got a little bit of a veneer that I don't quite buy sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like,
He was L.A. for he was L.A. for a while. But now he's back up in Spokane, and he's just parked there doing his thing. And it's really good. It's great stuff. Great. But
it's always frustrated me and fascinated me. Like, there's so much great stand-up in this country. And I sent a tweet out the other day that, you know, just hit me that I was reading something that Leno is worth $500 million. And he's just sitting around with his cars. He isn't doing anything. You know, he has a show on, you know, about his old cars. I'm like, who cares about your cars, dude? You came through stand-up comedy. You know, Letterman's worth $500 million. Seinfeld's worth $1 billion. Why don't these guys open 100 clubs? They don't have to run them. Just fund it. You know?
Oh, that'd be fun.
Put $1 million up for each club where you can start them in all these different cities and give back to stand-up. You know? Yeah. They gave you $500 million.
I wonder.
50 million back to stand-up.
Only a club must suck. That's it.
But they don't have to own it. They just put up the
money. That's true. Yeah, that's true. They're
we're going to start a master fund. In fact, what I said was the top 50 net earning comics should all put a master fund together of about $500 million. And then two great clubs in every city, all the top 100 cities. Could easily fund that.
Yeah, they could. They could fund at least 10.
How much does it cost to open up, you know, a 150 seat comedy club? Not that much.
It's $1 million or so.
I bet it didn't even that much.
I bet it could be less. Yeah, it could be less. And there's some cities without clubs, especially now. Man,
it would just change everything. You know, it's an art form that has to have audience, has to have great locations, has to have pre-funding, because otherwise they end up starting to book it, you know, to sell tickets, which is a horrible idea.
Oh, it gets bad. It gets papered and ugly real fast. It's amazing whenever I went to a club that was just even reasonably set up, it was not, you know, nice. Let alone every once in a while when you hit one, you're like, oh, this is, everybody on the staff gets it. Everybody,
right?
You know, this is nice. Even
did
that.
Did you have Charlie Goodnights back in the day?
I never got to do it. No, I dropped in there one night just on an off night because I happened to be doing a college or a corporate somewhere down there. That seemed like that would have been a fantastic club.
Yeah, I was based in Raleigh for 4 years, so I've been on that stage, I don't know, 500 times. And
is that great?
I remember like when new comics would come through as the first time there, you would just see their eyes, like the first response from the jokes, their eyes would just light up and like, oh yeah. Cause it's really, you know, it's small, it's all hard surface. The acoustics are perfect.
Yeah.
They'll pack 250, 300 people into that space. And you've never heard that kind of, you know, just sort of rumble
on deep, right on top of you. When I saw the setup, it's right on top of you. And I remember asking the booker at that point, this would be 2000 something. Well, wasn't he saying, you know, I'm not trying to, but, and by this time the supply to demand is just outrageous.
Yeah.
And then it does become, well, what kind of draw do you have? Period.
Well, and they had booked that club really well for a long time. So the audience was also very well trained. You know, they knew what to expect. You didn't have to pander at all. It was one of those kind of rooms. So.
Man.
Yeah.
Are they still around? Are they still there?
I don't know. It got handed off to much worse owners. And next thing you know, JJ Walker is, you know, headlining.
That's always. Oh, that's a sure symptom. That really, that's like you can't taste and smell now. You know what I mean?
Michael Winslow. Sad. Here's Michael Winslow.
Yeah. Yeah. But Winslow coming and it was some Pauly Shore.
Yeah.
Like, here we go.
All that. Joe Rogan just moved here to Austin, is talking, at least, you know, who knows what any of this has any texture to it at all, but he said he's going to try to open a club here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that'd be good. At least one, right?
Bought like 100 acres. It's ridiculous, you know.
He did?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe not. I don't know that many, but he's got enough to build a comedy club on it. That's for sure.
Well, I hope he does. I'll send my tape in. Me and a million guys.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, everybody looks at these things like Rogan, and again, it's this kind of, you know, genreized comedy. You know, they all, it's all that kind of rough and tumble, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that's not really my comedy. I don't, you know, it wouldn't do me any good for them to open that club.
Well, I guess if it's going to be comics like Joe. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like every 10 comics or somebody I would know that I would go hang out with, but typically, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't really super interest me. So, but we'll see. But comedy needs some support, man. Like I tell people, I think if you just got 100 great standups and you told them, I want you to do standup about the right and all this crazy politics, I want you to just develop that stuff. It's like, you know, 1,000 monkeys on hidden typewriters eventually will make Shakespeare. Yeah. I think the comedians would eventually hit on solutions that would actually work.
It would start to, eventually we'd find something.
Right? I mean, well, you know, you go at it from all these different angles and the mechanisms themselves, they just sort of spin out new ideas.
You mean like if the comics or, and it can't, but aren't we already doing that?
I mean, like reward it, like just organize it and then milk it like a farm. You know, it's like, we want you stand-ups to like your stuff. That's one of the things I've always liked about your material is that you go in and find you're chasing the most interesting idea. You know?
Yeah. When I'm doing, because this is interesting. Yeah. I hope it's funny. I mean, I'm trying to make it funny. But
funny becomes technique, right? But the idea itself is what launches it. Like that's where you get the brain explosion as the stand-up. You're like, oh, I've just thought of a new way of looking at this.
Yeah.
And then you know it's just treating it with technique to get all the comedy out of it.
Yeah. It's finding, I always felt like it was like, I have to give them the aha moment. Like I had that moment. I want them to like, oh my gosh. And I don't know what that impulse was, but for sure you're right, it's how do I get them to see that this is, and I felt
that's your that heroin about, right? I mean that is the little piece of heroin, like heroin. I mean that's all I do, that's the only thing that's ever interested me in life is finding new information and new ideas and new perspectives, and so I chase it all day long. Doesn't matter whether I'm doing academics or comedy,
you're looking for it of that. All the time. Yeah. And that's what I think, that's part of what's been so maddening the last few years, is chasing the ideas and then not being able to do anything with them, not being able to perform them, not being able to say like, I thought of this thing and blah, you know, the few times I got to do them that I liked them, they worked well, but man.
Well, it's one of the things I'm trying to teach people in like the Rhetoric Warriors course and the free webinars that I've been doing about how to convert the right. I've got a three webinar series that's for free on the website. You know, each one's an hour. And it's how do you take people through a conversion process that actually has, you know, some efficacy to it, some design so that you can get into those brains. Because what's happened to people's minds, you know, is very modernity oriented. It's very much part of the culture. You can put any content into people's brains. Like that's been proven by humanity forever, right? This idea that, you know, a guy in the Middle East, there's a Middle Eastern guy born 2000 years ago who was supernatural and still watches us.
Oh yeah. They'll believe anything. They can
80% of people believe that. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. A few years ago, I was playing Go Bananas, which is a wonderful room.
Yeah, it is.
And on the way there, I saw the exit to go see the giant arc that they made. The giant with giant arc. I said, I gotta go see this. And it was just astounding. And I came away from just kind of scared. Like, oh my God, people believe this. And I remember talking to one of my buddies who I think sometimes believes stuff he should never believe. And I said, wait, could you, this is, they take this literally. They have little crates in there with dinosaurs, baby dinosaurs. It's all about how Noah did it. And then there's even a plaque in there saying, you know, we don't know if this is exactly how Noah did this. We don't know. But we do know he succeeded because we have the Bible. So it's like, you know, like this circular logic, and it's everywhere. It's like in a museum. Is that, am I the right term? Circular logic, like just this, and it's a, it's one example of that kind over and over, like a whole ship full of just shitty logic. And I remember telling him, this terrifies me that we have how many million people that literally can float that? That's crazy.
Yeah.
And he said, what's the problem with it? And now I'm like, this is the problem. What we have going on now. This is
no,
the problem.
It's exactly the same thing. It's a, so the way you get to those places is through indoctrination systems. Like you grew up Mormon, you were indoctrinated. You know, that's an artificial belief system that you were started in as a baby, you know, without any choice, without, before you could do logic, you know, and it was installed like software in your head. And the only thing you can do at that point is if you are a logical person or you get another software installed, like, you know, academics or education, then it's going to fight that original software. And some people, you know, they lose that fight. Some people win that fight, but it's all just a mental software. And human beings, you can plug anything in there you want.
Well, that ship is floating in a lot of those. It's in there and it's crazy. And it's that ability. So I told my friend later, I know I'm scared, I guess. I'm scared that, he said, what does it matter if there's a bunch of people that believe that? So, because there's a bunch of people that can believe that, which means they can believe anything. And they tend to have a lot of guns too, by the way.
And they vote.
And it makes me nervous. It makes me nervous. And now I think they're radicalized. So
right. And that's the only thing that's different. Yeah. Like they've got channels to them now. Like the social media and cable media basically gave, before that it was AM radio, which was this obscure little barely used system. But it just broke out with social media and digital. You can now get those stories. It's basically all mythos persuasion. So it's all story based. Even though they talk logic, they're not really talking logical. So it's really just stories. And they tell really intense stories. They tell them really well. Professional communicators that are just amazing at talking, you know, and portraying emotion.
Yeah.
And it's super powerful. And we're not prepared for it.
At all. At all. Because we're, I think part of it too, is you were talking about, it's not just trying to, even if you can just sit down and talk to them and understand where they come, what, why they're saying, you know, like I'm interested in finding out, okay, why are you believing this story?
Sure.
Why are you gravitating to this ridiculous? What happened? What was it traumatic?
Yeah.
What caused all this?
Well, that is a lot of, it is, because you have to open people up, you know, emotionally, you know, to that stuff. And it answers very specific things. The same way religion answers fear of death and, you know, confusion in the world and this lack of meaning that people feel. It answers all those huge existential gaping wounds that people have.
Yeah.
And that's why people need it, you know?
Yeah. So my question is, we talked earlier about when things, when these minds get planted over with anyone with on the left or the right that has these, what it, hypersensitive word. Do you have any, I assume the same stuff applies for either kind of irrational, whatever that I bump into. Like if I happen to bump into someone who I think is insane, I don't know, crazy. On the other side of the aisle, it'll work, right? It's the same idea.
It's the same kind of idea, but it's the master fallacy in all of this that I keep finding over and over again is false equivalencies.
Absolutely. That's
so everybody wants to say, oh, they're crazy on the left and they're crazy on the right. I'm like, well, both of those statements may be true, but it's a different type of crazy.
Yeah.
And you
and it's a different amount.
The same way.
It's a different amount too.
Yeah. The left is still trying to do, you know, typically they're trying to do good logic. They've just been hypersensitized to social issues. So they want to, you know, basically do speed jury work, speed criminal trials, you know.
Yeah. on social media or Twitter.
Yeah. Like, as soon as they find any evidence, that's plenty. Jump to the conclusion and execute you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I found it on both sides, but the false equivalency for sure is.
Yeah. No, a lot of the same reactions are the tactics and the reactions and all that are the same, but the actual content and the way they're crazy is very different. So most of the things I do is for the right, because that I consider them to be the dangerous, you know, element. The left isn't calling, you know, to overthrow the government, you know.
No, last I saw they weren't. I mean, even when they did, and that's a false equivalency that's popped up a lot now, is I have friends that are comparing, well, look what the Democrats did when Trump won. They tried, I said, very different.
No,
Hillary Clinton conceded. She conceded, for one. Two, Russians were actually running disinformation.
Right.
And three, Trump was talking in a way that invited investigation constantly. Yeah. It's not like he was not saying outrageous and very suspicious things, like almost on a daily basis, if not more. We followed the rule of law all the way through. Like I told one of my friends, like he said, well, how about that FISA court? Now I'm losing everybody here, but you know, there was the FISA court that allowed to wire and tap Trump. And I said, well, that worked because see what that does is there's a record. We know who was involved. We can go in and look at who did what. It leaves fingerprints and witnesses. So people, there's accountability. In fact, they caught one lawyer for the Department of Justice who fibbed on an email and we caught him. But under Trump's system, oh, you're not going to catch anybody the way he's doing things. So they'll draw this equivalency that's so outrageously off. I mean, there's just no way. And when I point out the differences, they just, that's the first rule for when you make a false equivalency. You compare, but you ignore anything that doesn't serve. And they'll do that. They'll just bring up, look at all these similarities. I say, you're ignoring a shit ton of differences.
Yeah. So now you're trying to train them how to do logic again, which again is not going to work because their brains they've been moved off the foundation of logic. So like their techniques of doing that, but like when I do the conversion podcast, I usually have people on three times because it's a three-stage process. The first is just information, like just discover why they believe what they do and what they believe. It doesn't matter. Just let them, you know, flurry it out and don't challenge any of it, because you've got to get in and do some diagnostics. Like, why did this person grow up hyper Christian? Was this person wounded, you know, traumatized by somebody or, you know, some experience or long-term relationship? Was this person, you know, does this person just watch, you know, hyper kinetic, mesmerizing right-wing media? Like you'll never do any persuasion with anybody if they don't turn off, you know, their right-wing media, because it's just a bullhorn, you know, all the time in their head. And
it's the fire hose of just like misinformation, like we're saying, complexly stupid, complexly illogical.
And super produced and super powerful, and you'll never beat that.
Yeah.
So you've got to figure out what is getting them where they are. And then second is you got to start a relationship where they learn how to communicate. They trust that. And so I just ask them questions and I, you know, explore it more and they get used to that. And then you can start doing, you know, like I said, sort of tiny trail conversion, like get an island, just grab a little island. Like I sometimes do with like teaching the term false equivalency. They'll fail really quickly, you know, like they can't handle much teaching because there's too much flurry, you know, too much uproar going in their heads. But, you know, it may take a little bit, like, let's just look at one fallacy or the idea that logic has fallacies. They don't know that.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you might have to start there.
But if you get a little inroad like that, then that's what conversion, that's what I try to teach people, you know, with the courses, is that you have to have a much more sophisticated way of going into these people's minds, because their minds have been made, as you said, complicatedly stupid. And you can't just rail at it. You're logical, like upping your logic to an illogical person, never going to work.
Oh no. Yeah, you're right. I should realize that. It's like they're immune to that's not where they live. Yeah.
But you can't do a lot of it. It's exhausting. It's so much effort. One of the things I'm starting is this Convert One Conservative project. Mm-hmm. Where just pick every liberal, like there's 80 million of them just voted for Biden. Just pick one person and just concentrate on them for the next 2 to 4 years.
This is sounds like under, but elite, I like the idea of, first of all, if you get to know each other, if you literally just get together and just talk about anything but politics for a while. So there you get common ground right there. And you start to see, I think, complexity, which is a great, that's a great thing. That's a, you know, because that would be huge. Well, if we
persuading
all
persuading people in America, especially, which is weird because America is based on persuasion, but it's considered, you know, kind of rude. How dare you try to question my beliefs or not value my opinions? And I'm like, no, we have to be, this whole country is built on persuading people to vote a certain way versus somewhere else. But you have to work your way up to that. You can't just, you know, it's like going on an internet date and trying to stick your tongue down somebody's throat within the first 4 minutes.
never done that on any. Yeah. On a
jump
date.
In and try to persuade me. We just met.
Yeah. And I would say I've been doing that. I've been sticking the logical tongue down the throats of people on Facebook. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It just ticks people off. It just makes them angry. And they're like, oh, I thought you were a comedian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say do that as much as you want, but pick one person and take them through a conversion process. Because if 80 million liberals all went and got one person, then there would now be 160 million liberals. Like,
what if the conservatives are doing the same thing? You do know they are. They're going.
Yeah, but they can't do it. Conservatives can't convert. Conservatives don't persuade. The right doesn't persuade. They let the media do it for them.
Huh. You don't think the left does, like from the liberal side, does the media persuasion?
No, like tell me an aggravated left wing media persuasion that's just there to send out propaganda, highly slanted media, completely.
You mean like false, like blatantly lying? Yeah, because I haven't seen that going on.
No, they can't. They have to. They're too anchored by things like truth and reality and accurate information and all that kind of stuff.
Because I have bumped into things from the left where I've thought I don't buy it. Doesn't make sense. With different social issues, different within the soft sciences, we will say. Sometimes they become very soft, very extremely soft in the head, like stupid. Idiotic, and it gets weaponized. And but I had a bit about that, or tried about. I was reading some on the definition of racism, getting back to that bit I did before, and how someone sent me some. Well, this is what it is, you know, because you were arguing about what it even just means, and it's just page after page of this. I think there's someone, I don't know who they were. They're looking to build a reputation is what they were. But I remember telling them, if it's going to be this complicated for me to just understand what racism, we're done. We're fucked.
Right.
Because there is no way. There's got to be a simpler explanation for this word. And we got carried around. And people that wrote this need to go away. This guy needs to be out of the job, done. You know, yeah. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. The left is has a lot of clumsiness. It pushes people away. Like it's very poorly done in a lot of its communication, you know, like they'll push people away that want to agree with them. You know?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. They push me away all the time. I get in trouble because I'll tell people, and maybe you can correct me. I don't like the term white privilege. I agree with the idea. I understand what they're trying to say, but I don't like the word privilege in there because it's not a privilege for me to have my rights. You're supposed to take them for granted. That's how they work. You walk outside and you assume you're going to be able to act reasonably, pursuing your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and nothing bad will happen to you. That's a right. That's really not a privilege. That's a right.
Right.
That we're all supposed to have and just take for granted. We are. Now, there are people in the country who for centuries have not had that right. That doesn't mean I'm privileged. It means they are deprived.
Yes.
So I don't know the right word for them to use, but white privilege was the wrong word because there are a whole class of white people struggling, poor, who from the Appalachian, the Ozarks, the whatever, Rust Belt. And when you tell that person they're privileged, it is a profound insult right out of the gate. Hey, let's talk about my problems. You're privileged. Well, what? Guess what you just did, you jackass. So yeah. Whoever was in charge of the terms, that guy or gal, they need to be fired. They need to go away. That was a bad, bad, damaging. Yeah.
Lots of clumsiness with that stuff. Lots of it. And I, you know, my daughter is 21 and, you know, an avowed Austin, Los Angeles liberal. And, you know, hypersensitized to all of it. And she's a makeup artist. So she loves the trans community and drag queens. And it's something she actively thinks about a lot and, you know, has a lot of friends and she's constantly trying to, you know, correct the way I talk about it. And I'm like, no, I totally get what you're saying. I said, the problem is that I'm a linguist. I'm a linguistic professor, you know, essentially, like I study words.
Problem.
And your all these arbitrary fixes, these formal inorganic fixes to an organic language, that's not the way language works.
Yeah.
You know, we choose things in language because we like them. The whole culture likes them. They just work, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't just force things that are clumsy into the language and then punish everybody if they don't get it exactly right.
You don't. Just give me that dictionary. I got some words. It's not. I've told that to people a million times. The dictionary reports the uses of words. It reports it. It does not invent the words. Well, it's in there now. It reports what we bubble up out of our collective subconscious and out of language.
Incredibly organic.
Yeah.
Millions and millions and millions of words people use. And these are the ones that stick.
Yeah. And absolutely. So anyway, whoever came up with that, and there's several terms that those things will happen. And what are you guys doing? You're just shooting yourself in the foot, you know? Like I'm all on board with very much so on justice reform. And on systemic racism within justice. And this stuff's happening as I read it. But then when someone comes up and says, we'll call it defund the police. I'm like, what? Who, what are you doing? Who chose that? Who picked that? And I had a little argument with some of my comic buddies back in, they were defending it. And I said, I think it's a bad, you don't want shock value. It's clumsy for sure.
It doesn't do. And this is why you need rhetoricians. Look at these situations and make really good, creative, sophisticated choices so that you don't get blowback from your phrases and your slogans and your names and your words.
It's work. Yeah.
But that's not the people who are running, you know, social movements and, you know, groups and politics and everything else. And I think Biden's going to run into some of this. Like he, you know, I think I watched his speech, after the Electoral College the other day, and he's caught in a certain type of rhetoric right now, this sort of ceremonial, hey, we care about you, COVID. We're all done with that, dude. You won the election. It's time to move to a new type of rhetoric of I'm going to get shit done, you know, and if that takes a bulldozer to move these people out of the way, then I'm the bulldozer. You know, it's fine, but he's got to switch over, and whether they can becomes a sophisticated language challenge. Are they sophisticated enough to see what needs to be done now, how they need to talk in order to get what they want? And that's the whole basis of rhetoric. It's just, who am I talking to? What do they need to hear in order to give me what I want? And that is like language. It's a language challenge at that point. And defund the police, I think a lot of people, even on the right, would be like, if you said, hey, there are a lot of racists who end up in police departments, and that's causing real problem, or people not being racially sensitive to their own issues about being scared of, you know, black males because of, you know, years and years of horrible movies about it and everything else. We need to do some real training with the police. Everybody be like, yeah, that's probably true. But defund the police is...
You lose so many people. It's so... And then they, the other side has latched on. They're so good at using... The other side of this argument is so good at misusing data or stats.
Yeah.
That, you know, they'll tell you, well, if you get... It's, you're twice as likely to get killed by a black man than by a white man. You're like, really? What are the odds of that guy... killing me right there. Oh, about 0.000002. How about that guy? Oh, 0.000001. Don't you feel safer now? Well, not that when you put it like that.
Right.
But if you say twice as likely, and they latch onto these things, and they're so disingenuous on that side of the
within the that's where it becomes a sophisticated language competition. And you know, my whole thing is, I would like for people to have better training, more sophistication so they can win some of these things, because the left is, you know, it's got howitzers. And I mean, the right has howitzers, staining people and insulting people and misusing logic and falsifying things. Those are howitzers that you can just shoot off easily. You don't even have to be sophisticated, but if you don't know how to, you know, counter those things, depersuade people, defend against, you know, these types of persuasion, then you're going to be in trouble. And I think, you know, that's why this stuff has been, you know, I prefer just to do comedy too, but like, I'd like to teach people this stuff, maybe do some kind of help for democracy bent.
Yeah. Well, it's needed. It's needed for a democracy, especially if it's a dictatorship. We don't need this crap, but that's for true. Democracy, we need
life
it.
Would be so much simpler if we were just a dictatorship.
Well, I think that is a solid. I was going to say too, nowadays with QAnon, there's literally, I hear of people that literally lose family members or relationships.
Oh, it's everywhere. Everybody's got somebody in their family they've lost to a far right, you know, vision of the world. It's very powerful.
QAnon, nuts. It's nuts.
Well, this has been fun, man.
It's fun,
you know,
to visit.
Just excuses to talk to you guys is all I really want for the podcast.
It's fun. Take care out there. I don't know if you can be safe. What are the numbers, COVID numbers there?
They're not too bad in Austin. I mean, Texas, you know, is one of the places with a crazy governor who won't, you know, protect anybody. So it's always a little funky, but you know, I've basically shut down my life like everybody else for the last 10 months. So, beautiful. So far, so good. But yeah, I'll circle back around. Maybe in a couple months, we'll talk again. And you you can maybe dig into like some of the perspectives I'm interested in about the way Germany has dealt with, you know, some of these issues.
Oh, yeah. You know? We didn't even talk about that. Yeah, because it is interesting. The difference
for
is
sure.
Really interesting. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it, man. Everybody, this is Bent Washburn. Check him out at bentwashburn.com. Is that?
Yeah. For Facebook. Yeah, it is.
Got some great stand-up, man. I wish people go in, and you've got free stuff on Dry Bar. You've got paid stuff on your site. Bent Washburn, BENGT, and one of my favorite comics. Washburn. And again, thanks, buddy.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
All right. See you, man. Talk soon. See ya.
Yeah, we will. Bye.